interspaces.
An interdisciplinary podcast.
Welcome to Interspaces, the research podcast of Bielefeld University's Center for Interdisciplinary Research. My name is Rebecca Moltmann and I'm looking forward to today's episode. In the last Interspaces episode, I talked to Paula Diehl and Birgit Sauer, the conveners of the research group Normalizing the Far Right. This group has worked at CIF over the course of 2 years to jointly study the rise of right-wing populist and right-wing extremist parties, politicians, movements and groups. This has become a common phenomenon, contributing to the spread of far-right discourse and attitudes. During this time, the time of the group at CIF, we recorded different statements and perspectives with guests and fellows during a conference of the group. We tried to include different regional examples, definitions and insights into various examples and scenarios to give a broad overview about the topic and the differing expertise of the involved researchers. These statements should be understood in the context of the last episode to better grasp the overarching framework of the group's research subject, so make sure to give this a listen in advance of this episode or after that. The first researcher was Ruth Wodak, linguist, sociologist of language and discourse researcher from the University of Vienna, who has done a lot of research on populism, political communication, discrimination, etc. We covered the definition of normalization and talked about emotions and their connection to normalization. What is normalization?
Normalization is a process via which certain agenda, arguments, topics, themes, policies are taken from the extremes to the center. Usually we use this concept to describe and to grasp the processes via which the agenda from the far right are normalized, are mainstreamed into the center. That means or implies that other parties either reproduce or integrate those agenda into their own policies, or that the far right becomes more and more mainstreamed. Both processes are possible. In some, it means that certain taboos or, as one can also say, the unsayable becomes sayable and acceptable, but it also implies that certain policies become acceptable. So it's not only a question of form or of performance or of rhetoric, it's actually much more importantly a question of the political and what happens to liberal democracies.
How is normalization connected to emotions?
Normalization is connected to emotions as every policy and the political is connected to emotions. There is no politics without emotions. So it's much more the question which emotions are mobilized by which kind of agenda or by which kind of actions. But again, to just stress, there is no political which is just rational or cognitive. There is always the interplay between pathos, logos, and ethos. So just to go back to classic rhetoric, that is always interdependent. But what we now observe is that processes of normalization can be mobilized, supported, enforced by certain kinds of demagogy, which mobilizes certain emotions, mostly fear and anger, but also hate. And one important moment is that certain other emotions can be transformed into emotions which are directed against the others. So, for example, shame, which is defined as an emotion which is directed against oneself, is transformed into anger, which is directed against others. So in that way, normalization serves as a catalyst. Those emotions serve as a catalyst to actually enforce or make possible certain transformations also in our societies.
The next question actually was aiming at shame, because you, sure you wrote other papers, but you wrote a paper about the post-shame era in far-right populism, right?
Yeah.
Could you maybe explain in a few sentences what the paper was about?
I developed this concept of post-shame or shameless normalization, which relates to the phenomenon that shameless behavior serves as a catalyst to normalize certain agenda. So, for example, breaking taboo, flouting certain conventions, being insulting people, being extraordinary racist, sexist, misogynist, anti-Semitic, and so forth, provoke scandals, and in that way distract from the normalization of certain policies. We can observe that very clearly with Trump, for example, who succeeds in provoking scandals daily, but at the same time, when he was still president, implementing certain policies. The AfD, the FPÖ, and other far-right parties which are in opposition also use provocation and scandalization as strategies to distract from the policies which they actually endorse, and at the same time use a certain discursive means, rhetorical means, which basically are shameless or are used to de-shame what people were usually ashamed about. So there are many examples of the far-right politicians addressing the so-called modernization losers or the people who feel left behind, who feel ashamed because they are unemployed, because they have not achieved what one has to achieve in our neoliberal societies, but by telling them that there are certain guilty people, scapegoats, and that it is not their fault, but the structural fault or the fault of migrants or of other vulnerable groups. They succeed in de-shaming those people, giving them back their pride, for example, and at the same time mobilizing them against those scapegoats.
I think that's so interesting and fascinating and horrifying that people, I mean, it's a good thing that the de-shaming in itself, but you can like, I don't know. Instrumentalize it for,
For very bad means, So you could instrumentalize it for things which we think are good or for things which we think are bad, because, for example, left-wing populists also attempt to de-shame vulnerable groups, but not by creating scapegoats in that way. So they also talk about giving dignity back to the people without sort of excluding certain groups, whereas the far right is exclusive and follows an exclusive and excluding politics.
Following up on the topic of emotions, the next speaker was Brigitte Bargetz from Kiel University. Her research focuses on the democratic theory, effect studies, populism and feminist and queer theory, and we concentrated on the area of feelings and how the far right uses them to advance their goals. And what can you say about the normalization of the far right regarding your grammar of feeling?
So, as a political scientist, I'm exactly dealing with the question of how emotions, feeling, affects and politics are related, And the idea of the political grammar of feelings is an idea in order to think about how politics and emotions, feelings, affects are related. So because in political science for a very long time, people have not dealt with feelings and emotions. So it's kind of a new thing. And it's also important to theorize this, relation. And I have suggested in my work this notion of a political grammar of feelings. And I'm trying to differentiate two different dimensions of this political grammar of feelings. So on the one hand side, I argue that feelings are something that is instrumentalized by politics. So politics relates to feelings. For instance, if there are any ascriptions of female, of women being less rational than men in politics. So this is a way how feelings are used within politics. So this is what I call a politics of feelings. On the other hand, so the second dimension is that I also say there is something that I call feeling politics. Feeling politics means that political structures, different power structures, different power relations are also felt within our everyday. So how are political ideologies felt? How do people conceive of political structures? And this is what I call feeling politics. So I think, or I would like to argue that this kind of feeling politics is a way of acknowledging, a way of understanding the political in everyday feelings.
Can you maybe give examples for both of these subjects?
As I've said, the feeling of politics is probably something that we can, for instance, think about when it's about racism. So how is racism felt within the everyday? This is a way of really also acknowledging, of knowing what is going on. And it's not only something that is in our minds, but it's also in our bodies, how people do feel racism, how they encounter racism within their everyday. So this is one example of feeling politics. A politics of feelings, I would say this is also a politics of fear. For instance, if fear is produced, fear is manipulated, and this is the way how politics also works with feelings in order to mobilize people.
How did you come across the subject? So you said in political science it wasn't really usual to look at emotions and feelings. How did you decide to take a look at that?
Yeah, my background is in feminist theory, and coming from feminism, the dichotomy between the public and the private, between what is considered rational public, the public sphere, and the supposedly unpolitical private sphere, so what is emotional. This has been criticized for a very long time. And from this perspective, feminist approaches have really shown that also the seemingly only private or the emotional is also political. And another perspective that I've been for a long time working with is a cultural studies perspective. And I have a lot of, I've dealt a lot with Lawrence Grossberg, who has started working on the relation between politics and feelings in the 1990s, also referring to the state and how the state also organizes, produces consent within the people by feelings, by referring to emotional aspects of life.
We just talked with Wodak about shame as something that is like exploited, instrumentalized by the far right. Could you name other like types of feelings, emotions that are being used to maybe push them further to the center?
I mean, I think I'm not so much dealing with specific feelings, but in my perspective, I rather ask what are the moods where the far right really touches upon. So what is the contemporary mood that has been going on, and where the far right can bring up these mood and can make them stronger. So one of my probably most important claims is that with the current multiple crisis, there is kind of a feeling of anxiety and an insecurity. And in this moment of insecurity, of anxiety, of precarity within the multiple crisis, there is also a kind of hopelessness, of depression, political depression going on. And I would argue that this very moment of depression, of anxiety, leaves an open space where the promises of democracy are kind of vanishing. So what I would argue is that the far right explicitly can take up and can use this very moment of anxiety in order to bring in their own ideas and give some answers how this anxiety can be overcome, how political agency can be gained again. So I wouldn't say it's very specific feelings, and then of course anxiety is something that people feel, so the way the multiple crisis is something also how people relate to this multiple crisis in the mode of anxiety. But of course, also anxiety is produced by very specific politicians, but also by the far right in order to produce anxiety, anxiety in terms of fear of migrants, for instance, or fear of different others. And this is a kind of a politics of feelings in that sense. Feelings are also produced within the very political context.
Jan-Werner Müller, political scientist from Princeton University who focuses on democratic theory, constitutionalism and populism, talked about how populism in general challenges democracy and specifically about the situation in the European Union and the US. How is populism challenging democracy?
So there are clearly many definitions of populism out there. If you ask me, populism is not primarily about criticizing elites or being angry with the establishment. It's basically about leaders, parties, saying that they, and only they, represent what these leaders will often call the real people, or also very typically the silent majority. Two things follow from this, and both are problematic for democracy. First, these leaders are also going to claim that all other contenders for power are fundamentally illegitimate. They don't treat others as their political opponents. If in doubt, they treat them as enemies who are dangerous to democracy. And secondly, and even more perniciously and less obviously, populists are also going to insinuate that those who don't share their ultimately symbolic construction of the real people or who do not support them politically, that with all those citizens, you can put into question whether they truly belong to the people at all. So long story short, populism, in my view, is not so much about anti-elitism. It's about the tendency to exclude others, pretty obviously at the level of party politics, less obviously at the level of the citizenry themselves, where usually it's already vulnerable minorities who are told you don't truly belong. So it's really about what you might call anti-pluralism and not so much anti-elitism.
What are the differences between European and US right-wing populism?
From my point of view, there are many structural similarities. The way Trump talks in many regards is not that different from the way that, let's say, far-right European populist leaders talk. But since populists on one level basically transform political questions into questions of belonging, and since belonging is always connected to wider cultural frames, of course they do differ in terms of content. So they draw on different, if you like, cultural resources. They draw on different historical and also cultural repertoires when they try to make plausible to their followers what they understand to be the real people. So there are important differences in terms of general content. There are differences in terms of ideological fragments they use. As hopefully has become clear, I don't think of populism as an ideology as such. But of course, populist leaders need to say something about what they stand for and above all, what they consider to be the real people. So they do need content. But that also means that basically content differs from country to country.
This concept of real people, can you say where this is coming from? So, because the silent majority, I guess in a lot of fields, it's often called out, but I don't really know where the notion is like coming from.
So the silent majority, certainly in the US context, was first made really famous by Richard Nixon. And I'm not saying that anybody who uses the term is necessarily dangerous for democracy. But the kind of framings we see in the case of populists are partially dangerous, because if you kind of go along with my understanding of populists basically claiming a monopoly of representing the real people, or simply the people as such, then all of them have a major, major problem if they lose elections, or if they don't win elections in an overwhelming manner. I mean, how can that be that they are the ones who stand for the people and they don't win? So what happens quite often, I'm not saying this always happens, this is not an empirical regularity, but quite often what happens is that populist leaders who are on the losing side essentially suggest to their followers, let's take a second look at what happened here. And what they often insinuate then is that, of course, if the silent majority could have expressed itself, they would have won. The fact that they didn't win must mean that something or somebody must have silenced the majority. So not so much the silent majority as opposed to the silenced majority. Hence, there is a kind of elective affinity, if you like. Again, not a straightforward causal relation, but a kind of elective affinity between this sort of stance and the tendency to engage in a certain kind of conspiracy theory, where you essentially say, look, you know, usually the liberal elites will have kind of manipulated things behind the scenes. Otherwise, we would, of course, have won. So again, I'm not saying this always happens, but it's always, I think, a temptation. And note that even if nothing too dramatic happens, so nobody turns up in Washington, D.C. and tries to take over the Capitol, nevertheless, there is a cost for democracy. Because in a sense, the sense that our institutions are at least halfway functioning is weakened among the followers of the populists. Now, if I may, as one sort of qualification to this, of course, I'm not saying that we can't criticize our institutions. Of course we can. Especially in the US, you can say a lot of things about what's wrong with the electoral system. Absolutely no question about it. But there's a difference between basically offering critique that is relatively abstract and one that essentially comes down to saying, because I didn't win, our system is rotten. The first one is a democratic stance, the second is not.
How would you evaluate the future of the European Union in the light of a normalized far right?
So I generally don't make predictions, especially not about the future. But I can say maybe one or two words about what maybe particularly characterizes our present. First of all, it's now a well-established fact that you have entrenched far-right governments inside the EU. You have one state where I think observers are right to say that it's becoming a consolidated autocracy. The country I'm talking about is, of course, Hungary. This would have been unthinkable in previous eras. You cannot say that, oh, this is just one bad apple. It has no consequences. It has a lot of consequences for how the EU operates. That's number one. Number two, as many of our colleagues have pointed out, the real trend is not captured by the ubiquitous expression populist wave, which also, by the way, if one accepts it, can lead to a certain kind of political defeatism, because, you know, who among us can possibly stop a wave? A much better way to capture what's happening is the expression mainstreaming of the far right. So the fact that more and more basically center-right conservative actors are either willing to enter outright coalitions with the far right, or are willing to copy far right rhetoric in one form or another. And there are many, many reasons why this is happening. But I think one that is maybe less obvious is that in a certain way, the center right, and in particular Christian Democrats, have kind of run out of ideas. And that includes visions for a European future. Now, as a democratic theorist, I'm always in danger of being charged with, oh, you vastly overestimate ideas, you know, who reads party programs, and so on. That's all true. Nevertheless, the fact that Christian Democrats and other conservatives don't really have very clear programmatic statements anymore also makes it more difficult for them to say, here are the boundaries, and here are the lines, and here is what we absolutely don't stand for. I think in a previous era, if some of these characters had heard Viktor Orban talk about Christian democracy is all about the nation state, they would have said, no, we actually want to transcend the nation state in certain ways. We are the party that has a distinctly European program. Hence, this is a total falsification of our tradition. But you don't hear that so often anymore. So that's just one aspect of what might be happening there. But it has a sort of peculiar European dimension. And if we think about the upcoming European elections, clearly we might see a lot in terms of far-right actors and more established center-right and conservative actors maybe trying to form new alliances. And the one place where this might be most acute and most worth watching is, of course, Italy, because there are reasons to think that with the death of Silvio Berlusconi, Forza Italia might not have much of a future. The conventional wisdom now is that Giorgia Meloni turned out to be a much more normal, harmless person who doesn't abandon Ukraine, seems to even be following the commission's recommendations, etc., etc. So there might possibly be quite a lot of takers in terms of can we possibly bring her into the fold, because traditionally the center-right at the supranational level in Europe has always wanted to be the largest party. And for that to happen, they've often made, I would say, pretty unsavory compromises with certain actors.
Katrine Fang is a sociologist from the University of Oslo, and her research focuses on nationalism, right-wing populism, migration and social movements. In this talk, we mainly focused on the situation in Norway, the resistance movement, etc. Who are the actors that challenge democracy in Norway and Denmark?
In Norway and Denmark, well... Yeah, about Denmark, you should have asked Anita Nissen, because that's her field of study. But in Norway, yeah, depends how you define it, because you have, for example, extreme actors like Nordic Resistance Movement. But I don't think we could say they are a big challenge to democracy, because they have so few members in Norway right now. And there was, for example, a street demonstration organized by Nordic Resistance Movement in 2018, and all of the demonstrators were arrested, and only four of them came from Norway. The other ones were from Sweden, and a few of them were from Denmark. So they're not like a big movement if you look at the more extreme actors. But of course, that's a challenge of democracy from the far right in Norway as well. I think maybe mostly in discourse, actually. So that you see actors who don't believe in mainstream media, for example, who think that they present fake news and who then present themselves as particularly knowledgeable people who know more about things than the mainstream does. Those are, of course, challenging democracy. But they are not a strong force in Norway, so I would say. So it's not a challenge for politics in general, for example. But of course, the discourses are prevalent in Norway as well now, with anti-woke, for example, and this kind of cultural war rhetoric. And I think that's challenging. And how also, for example, topics like gender become polarized. That's worrying, I think. And also how, like in this workshop here, that we talk about the normalization of the far right, that far right ideas have become more mainstream. And if you, for example, look at attitudes towards Muslims, there have been a survey by the Center for Holocaust Studies, and they found that one third of the population actually believe that both Muslims become too many, and also that there's a bit truth in the idea of Islamization of society. So you see that what was first a conspiration theory has become more mainstream thought. So that's worrying. So it's worrying especially to minority groups, but also to human rights in general, when these ideas become too widespread.
What is the role of the migration or anti-immigration discourse for normalizing the far right in Norway?
Mm. Yeah. One part of it is that I think anti-immigration views are not only part of the far right anymore. They are part of mainstream, but also to some extent far left policies. Not in general the far left policies, not like the two dominant far left parties, for example, but more individuals who circulate these ideas. So that we see that anti-immigration discourse is not only typical of the far right anymore. It is much more widespread. And I think also, for example, lately the development in Sweden with a lot of, you know, violent attacks by immigration youth has led, previously it was like only the far right talked about what they labeled Swedish conditions, which were like a label of decay, and how society would develop if we allow too many immigrants to come. But now Sweden is used as an example of bad development also for mainstream politicians and even left-wing ones. So it's used also as a way of saying that this is what is going to happen if we allow too much immigration to Norway. So, yeah, that's how the discourse has become mainstreamed.
And would you say that's for migration and anti-immigration discourse as well? So for both alike?
No, not necessarily. I mean, there's a difference between those who advocate for pro-migration and those who advocate against migration. But I think that it has become more legitimate to advocate very strict immigration policies, much more mainstreamed than it was 15 years ago, for example. But you also have nuances to this picture, because after the civil war in Syria, there was a record high of asylum seekers to Norway. I think it was like 30,000 the first year after the conflict started. And then, and then there was voices against, you know, allowing so many, and that also they could be radicalized individuals among all those that were allowed. Whereas now, with the war in Ukraine, it has been also very many immigrants to Norway, but with a much more rhetoric of that this is legitimate because they are sort of part of us. They are Europeans. So it's very interesting to compare those two situations. So in that sense, it's much more pro-immigration now than it was in 2016. So it's different who they are, if they are part of a broader us or not.
Yeah, I think what I was referring to was also what I kind of see, like even in pro-migration people or parties or whatever, they also saying like we have to close it at a certain amount. Mm-hmm. And like, I don't know, I think that's kind of walking towards the discourse of the anti-immigration.
Yeah.
Because it's like the same argument, but they mean like it in a different way. But I think it's quite interesting.
Yeah, I think we have seen a lot of normalization of this kind of rhetoric. And also, for example, the rhetoric of that the nearby countries or the countries nearby the conflict, like in the Middle East, for example, should take more, and we should rather support those countries in taking refugees instead of taking them to Norway. And that sort of rhetoric was previously only on the far right, but now it's also among the mainstream, like even the Labour Party and the Conservative Party.
Yeah. Exactly. Why do you think the anti-immigration mobilization has been more successful, or how do they propagate?
Successful in mainstreaming the idea that we shouldn't have too much Muslim migration. I think that idea has, and also not only Muslim migration, but also too many, refugees that will cause a strain on the welfare system. So people who do not have higher education, who do not have the language and the resources and so forth, so that they will be a burden to the welfare system. This kind of welfare chauvinism has become very much mainstream, I think. And we have had, for example, two governmental appointed committees in Norway looking on the sustainability of the welfare state and how immigration challenges that sustainability. So that kind of mainstreaming we have had. Yeah.
What are the difference in anti-immigration discourses in the two countries?
It's in Scandinavia, Denmark has for a long period of time now had the most restrictive immigration policy and also the most restrictive public debate around immigration. And Sweden has been the most liberal and Norway has been placed in the middle. So we can still see these differences today. So, but of course, Norway has developed in direction of Denmark, but very lately we see the same in Sweden after very many violent attacks that suddenly the politicians also in Sweden start to advocate for a more strict immigration policy.
The next speaker was Luciana Villas-Boas, literary and cultural science scholar from the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro. Her research investigates the interaction between concepts and images of power, concentrating on the literature and intellectual history of the early modern period. We talked about the situation in Brazil, Bolsonaro and the iconography regarding the debate around the political developments. So you wrote a book in 2022, which is called The Republic in Slippers, Bolsonaro and the Dismantling of Representation. How did you come up with the idea for the book and what was the original thesis for the book?
I was back then working on the iconography of the early modern period, images of rule, images of power, and realized at some point that it was gathering knowledge to talk about a dimension of power and politics that is often neglected, if not entirely repressed, namely the symbolic, imaginary, theatrical, choreographical dimension of power that is essential to make power visible and therefore intelligible and socially viable.
And in terms of iconography, like moving towards the direction of far right, or in Bolsonaro's case, what kind of iconography does he use or does he profit from?
I'm so sorry, I didn't answer your question. So I was all of a sudden I was invaded by the present and turned to images that seemed to me fundamental, were like synthesizing images, were like, in German one would say, following Avi Warburg, they were Schlagbilder. They were synthesizing the historical moment of the electoral process when Bolsonaro won, and then the way his performance in power as president, and how that was threatening the very understanding of institutional power, the existence of institutional power. So there are two essays in this book. This book is addressed to a broader public, to a wide educated public, and it is conceived truly as an intervention in the debate. It was also the first time I had to give interviews on the radio, even TV programs, something I wasn't used at all. And this was 2022, before the election. So the book came out early 22, precisely to perform this role, to bring this up in public debate. And I would say that one of the most important images still is an image produced during the first round of the 2018 elections, when the ballot, the artifact itself, was in the forefront of debate. Bolsonaro voters entered the voting booth with guns, put the guns on the ballot. Some of them voted with a gun, took pictures and even videos and published them, posted them on social media. So it was so outrageous because it is obviously not a violation of an electoral norm only that is at stake, but a symbolic violence that I thought I needed to spell out. There's a statement about the nature of power. There is an attack on the state, on the monopoly over violence, on the very nature of voting. Voting obviously comes from voice, from speaking, from discourse, not from force, from violence. So I was already back then when this happened, trying to understand what was going on. Then in the second round of the election, an actress, she initiated what a participant at the event yesterday and I decided could be called a counter-protest. Although it led up to a counter image. She asked all anti-Bolsonaro voters, so Haddad, the other candidate from the Workers' Party voters, to take a book with them to the voting booth. And this was organized on Twitter, but hundreds, thousands of people took to the streets on the election day holding a book as a response to the guns on the ballot. So one of my essays in this Bolsonaro book deals precisely with these two images as synthesizing images of the historical moment and images that themselves have an efficacy. They operate in what was going on then.
And would you say that, I mean, it was the voting situation already, so it wasn't much like a Wahlkampf anymore.
It was still the electoral struggle.
Yeah.
Very much.
What I was trying to point towards was they have to portray themselves in a certain way to win like voters for the next round of votes. So would you say that this really powerful imagery does something with the maybe future voters who didn't vote in this election, but like think like, oh, the books or the guns speak to me?
I think it was certainly the two images correspond to the candidates very much, to what they symbolized and how the two candidates, their conceptions, their attitudes towards democracy. So on one side was Bolsonaro, whose symbol, gesture, compliment is to make a little gesture that shows a gun. This is how hardliners, supporters of Bolsonaro identify themselves. They have been working for decades for the relaxation of gun rights, for the amplification of gun rights. So there is this idea that the individuals should arm themselves, truly a threat to the state monopoly of the legitimate means of violence. And on the other hand, there was a candidate who had been a teacher, was a teacher. So this was very prominent together with this movement against the guns on the ballot. Some of the imagery via Twitter showed Haddad as a teacher. So this is also, and what I try to do is to understand how the central symbol of democracy, the ballot as an instrument of popular sovereignty, was at stake. But then what does the ballot mean? What happens in the ballot? What does the ballot mediate? There is participation, but there is also a moment of representation and even a moment of transformation when the will of all, the majority, becomes the general will and the elected president will have to govern for all. And of course, the history of the ballot in Brazil, I also try to deal with that, this long history of democracy and redemocratization in our country. So it was really what was at stake. These two images teach us that what was at stake is a conception of democracy and how we understand democracy, and also that these that this threat to democracy is produced within democracy.
And concerning the history of Brazil, why would Bolsonaro and his supporters think that these guns are like a really good way to represent their goals? And why would it work in Brazil? Because I can't really imagine, I can imagine other countries where this would work, I think, quite well. Like, can't imagine it in Germany, for example, because I think the far right would like be more subtle about things like guns. I mean, because it's, in my opinion, I would read it as a kind of, they are ready to use violence for everything that they stand for. And I think there would be countries in which it would be like another imagery that is used. So can you say something in context of the history of Brazil? Why would they do that there?
Absolutely, yes. It's related to many things. I mean, both guns and books are symbols that are deeply ingrained within culture, right? So this is why how these two Schlagbilder synthesizing images could work during the electoral process. But guns, well, one obvious thing is that it is an accessory, a powerful accessory that stands for a certain kind of masculinity. And one doesn't need to think much that when one takes a gun to vote on the urn, on the ballot, this, that, what kind of violent fantasy is being actually staged against the bodily, the female body of the ballot, right? That was very clear and even made explicit. Then, of course, the guns are used as an expression of individual freedom, against communism, against gender ideology, against the poor who may take away your bicycle or your car, and against the state, because the state cannot protect you. So it is your right as an individual to have your own guns. And there was an increase of over 65% within the two first years of his government and guns in the country. And scenes of, and within the history of Brazil, I would claim that there is a long history that related to voting rights, to the expansion of voting rights. There was the so-called voto de cabresto, when local authorities forced those who worked for them to vote for a certain candidate. So I think that this was also invoked through that image of the guns on the ballot.
You talked about images and counter images already. So generally speaking, I think that's a really powerful example for how important counter images are in, mm-hmm. in scenarios like this. Can you say anything about the moving farther right than it is? Because like when Bolsonaro wasn't elected, so how is the current state of moving to the far right?
Yes, I've been thinking, and all the more so since this week, I met with colleagues who concern themselves with this issue. And I now would speak of my own work slightly differently. I think that what I called a representational rupture, the way Bolsonaro performed in office, refusing to the office and all the protocols and the limits imposed by the office, while he was constantly threatening an institutional rupture, coup d'etat, that these two dimensions are inextricably linked. So finally, after 4 years in power, holding office and yet trespassing on all conventions, protocols, norms, and in a sense, normalizing this kind of authoritarian, unpredictable behavior, it should not have surprised us that an actual institutional rupture was being prepared. Because the invasion of Brasilia, a week after the presidential inauguration, Lula's inauguration, was an organized movement. It did not sprout did not come from anywhere. And it is, I think, related to this incredible fragility of the political institutions. And I think that what was at stake both in the inauguration and in the invasion of Brasilia, the capital, is the persistence, the permanence of the political institutions of the Brazilian state, the state of law, rule of law, very much so. So I would read the inauguration as an affirmation of the ballot, popular sovereignty, and the whole institutional framework that allows it to work, and the invasion as the attempt to dismantle everything, including the architecture that gave permanence and stone to this, to rule of law. And what it made clear is that the newly elected government did not control the army, did not control the security forces, that the state monopoly over violence was, the state did not have it, the new governors did not have it. There was an interlude of uncertainty. Nobody knew whether or not the invaders would be dispersed.
Would you like to say something else? I don't know, some kind of statement focusing on the conflicts, open conflicts, instead of like normalizing?
Yes, I would love to. I think it is paramount to think about mechanisms, typologies of normalization of the far right. I don't know how to do it, but I think we should try to, we shouldn't neglect the resistance and the protests and the attempts at assuring the continuity of what we call democracy, representative democracy. So I still think that these two images produced in 2023 in January in the Brazilian capital, Lula's inauguration ceremony and the invasion of the Three Powers Square, that these will remain two powerful Schlagbilder that will condition the way we think about democracy in the present, in the future, not only in Brazil. And the invaders were dispersed. And there is, again, gun control in the country. And the army seems quiet for the time being. And yeah, business goes on. And it's true that there are many parallels between the invasion of the capital in US and the invasion of Brasilia of the capital in Brazil. There are similarities in the script and in how this was even organized. But there's also a very important difference that is often neglected, namely the role of the military. Because in the US, the military worked independently and was able to perform its institutional role. While in Brazil, this was not at all the case. We saw security agents, the police, the army, not only sympathetic at times, even supporting the invaders and the movement that started right after the elections. So it is very important to understand Bolsonaro and the rise of the extreme right, the normalizing of the extreme right, to the revisit this very difficult question of the role of the military in Brazil, in the history of democracy in Brazil, how the military fashioned themselves as, now I don't know the word in English, how they protected, took to themselves the task of assuring the institutionality of power and how problematic that can be.
The next guest was Dieter Rucht, political scientist and sociologist who worked a lot on social movements, political participation and social change. We focused on strategies of right-wing protests and counter-protests. Is there something like a protest pattern of the far right?
I'm reluctant to say yes. I would rather say no. There is no classical pattern how right-wing activists protest in the streets. Over time, we see that they are protesting louder. They are becoming more and more people in the streets. They are more self-confident. But the very form of protest hardly changes over time. Well, if we are talking about the way how they present themselves or how they define their opponents or how they define the ordinary people, I think this has become more developed, more sophisticated, and more systematic over time. So there is a strategy of framing that becomes better and more effective, also because they relate to the actual problems of many people. And currently in these days and in these years, we have a lot of problems, not just imagined problems, but real problems. And they can link to this, and in partly they can connect to the people because it corresponds, the problems they are raising, it corresponds to the actual experiences of these people in daily life.
How did the protests against the anti-COVID measures affect the far right?
In the end, I think it strengthened the far right because quite often we have seen ambivalent or mixed protests where the call for action was not coming from the far right, but from people who were rather conservative or people who belong to the populist camp, which is more moderate than the radical right. And once they went to these demonstrations, they said, well, I have good reasons to be here. And when there is a real right-winger, a hardcore right-winger standing next to me, I don't care because he or she is sharing the goals that I also endorse.
Did you identify successful protest strategies against the far right? And if yes, which one and where?
Well, if you see the recent developments, we can hardly speak of any success to contain, to reduce the level of right-wing activity. So if we use that as a measure, then I think the counter-strategies are failing. In terms of counter-strategy, I think there is not a single strategy that promises to be successful. Because we are dealing not with one type of people, at a closer look, we will see that there are different kinds of people, different strands of protesters, and these strands of protesters require different answers. I'll give you an example. On the one hand, we have the so-called concerned citizen, people who are politically not really interested, people who hardly vote for a party, people who want just to enjoy their private life. And now, for whatever reasons, the state interferes in their lives and sets conditions that they dislike. So they protest. And these people are an important addressee for the right-wingers, but they are also an important addressee for people who are pro-democratic. And these people can be influenced, I think, once we are doing this in the right way. And by influenced, I mean we shouldn't try to manipulate these people. We should listen to them and not just trying to agitate them. And if you follow such a course of a dialogue, an open-minded dialogue, I think we cannot win all these people, but at least parts of them. On the other hand, there are people who are already deeply anchored in the radical right camp, so to speak. And here it's very hard to convince these people. We can question their statements about empirical facts. Is this true or is it not true? How can you substantiate your claim or your critique? So we can raise counter-arguments, and sometimes also they respond to that. And maybe even if we cannot convince them in the first instance of the conversation, they may think about it. Well, probably I'm not 100% right. Probably he or she was wrong in questioning that. So to some extent, these people can be reached, not really convinced, in their overall mentality or political positions, but in some respects. But certainly you have people who don't listen, people who don't accept the facts you can present, not just as an individual, but as a generally accepted scientific fact. And regarding this group of people, I wouldn't invest any energy. Let them just talk, let them do what they want, unless it's not violating the laws and the conventional rules of civil behavior. That's it.
As you have heard, there are a lot of examples and perspectives to illustrate the normalization of the far right and how far this problem has spread around the globe. I already mentioned in the intro of this episode that you should definitely listen to the last episode about this subject. In addition, there will be an update, one more episode, with Paula Diehl and Birgit Sauer regarding the elections in Germany and other developments that were still up in the air during the recording of the last episode. Keep your eyes and ears peeled for this one and make sure to check out the show notes with links to our guests in this episode. Thanks for listening and until next time.